From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now. The Omicron variant ripped through the United States in January and filled many hospitals to capacity, but the virus, it couldn't stop job growth. Today, the Labor Department reported a stunning gain of 467,000 jobs last month.
President Biden spoke about the report this morning.
Our country is taking everything that COVID has to throw at us, and we've come back stronger. I'm pleased to report this morning, but many of you already know, that America's job machine is going stronger than ever.
And Michael Regan joins us to talk about this job machine. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. And Mike, 467,000 jobs. Who got hired? What sectors?
Well, the hiring was pretty strong across just about every industry. I'll give you a few examples. Leisure and hospitality, 151,000. Professional and business services, a pretty broad category of sort of white-collar jobs, 86,000. Retail was 61,000. One I think is really important is transportation and warehousing. You know, this has sort of been part of the issue with all the supply chain problems. Job growth there, 54,000. So pretty widespread across the board, Scott.
Yeah, and well, I mean, so much for Omicron denting January. And with these job numbers, we also saw big revisions upwards for the job numbers in October and November. So if you put it together, is this a potential sign that employers and maybe the broader economy is reverting to some version of normal?
I think that's a good way to frame it, yes. From the hiring side, the labor market's been red hot for months now, almost 11 million job openings in the U.S. That's way off the charts historically. But there was obviously a lot of reluctance among some people to take those jobs, you know, whether it be they are still nervous about the virus or can't find the right childcare, that sort of thing. So it seems like those headwinds to the employment picture are slowly abating. We are getting a little bit back to normal. More people are looking for work and taking these open jobs. So a pretty solid sign for the economy.
Yeah. Right. No, I did see that labor participation rate number also jumped. Now, there were 11 million unfilled jobs in December. So businesses are still looking for workers. And there are almost 3 million jobs fewer than existed before the pandemic. So when you kind of look at the openings here, what's happening in the labor market?
Well, a lot of moving pieces. I think one thing you saw was that many of the older people in the labor force might have retired early, that the markets have been really booming. So their investments accounts allow them to do that. And again, issues with everything from childcare to people just not thinking the risk of coming back into the workforce was enough. I think the wage gains are a big part of it. You look at average hourly earnings in this report, up 5.7% year over year. So that's really drawing a lot of people in, especially on those lower end jobs who otherwise might not have taken them. You know, the wages are now attractive enough to pull people who had sort of been sitting out the job market back into it.
I mean, wages, as you say, going up 5.7% over the previous year, but that's still not keeping up with inflation, right? Which is moving at a 7% or so clip.
That's right. That's the latest consumer price index, 7%, you know, the highest in 40 years. I think there is still a lot of belief among economists that that should come back down to earth. Probably not as fast as was hoped and expected, and that hot inflation may linger a little bit longer this year, but eventually it should get back to normal, whereas wage gains are a little more sticky. Once you get a raise, it's hard for an employer to take that back and cut your pay. So with any luck, they sort of balance out eventually, and these wage gains stick as inflation comes back to earth.
Yeah, and real quick, with these wage gains, with these numbers, should we still assume the Federal Reserve is going to plan to raise interest rates in March?
Absolutely. I think, and in fact, the thinking is sort of leaning towards the idea that it might be half of a percent raise rather than a quarter of a percent. So definitely the Wall Street is expecting some sort of raise, whether it be a quarter of a percent or a half a percent.
All right. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Scott.
On yesterday's show, we take a deeper look at the political climate swirling around the former President Donald Trump as he considers another run for the White House in 2024. Today, the legal problems that are now piling up against him. Andrea Bernstein is covering that side of the story for NPR, and she joins us now. Hi, Andrea.
Hey, great talking to you.
Good to talk to you. And there are several cases in different jurisdictions. So let's start with New York, where there's a criminal and civil case ongoing related to his businesses. What's the status of those?
So in the first case, the civil case, the most dramatic piece of new development in that is that the New York Attorney General filed this massive document last month in which she claimed that there was significant evidence of civil fraud by members of the Trump family. And she was asking for the depositions of Donald Jr. And Ivanka Trump. The Trump's lawyers have filed a motion to quash that, so that's currently in litigation. But in the course of it, she laid out much of her evidence that she's gotten so far, at least some part of it, that shows from these documents what looks like a pretty systematic practice by the Trump family business of vastly overvaluing their properties when it was worth it for them to do that, undervaluing them when it wasn't, and thereby the claim is perhaps defrauding taxpayers, bankers, or insurance companies.
Well, Donald Trump has defended himself against those allegations. Here he is recently at a rally in Texas.
We relied on major law firms, accounting firms, and other professionals to do this work. And to the best of my knowledge, they did it very, very well.
And then this week, his lawyers argued that Trump is being targeted for political reasons by the New York Attorney General, Letitia James. And in a filing, they included video examples to support that claim, including this one from 2018 when she was running for office.
We are angrier and more deeply divided than we've ever been at any point in our history since the Civil War. And at the eye of the storm is Donald Trump, ripping families apart, threatening women's most basic rights, and running for Attorney General because I will never be afraid to challenge this illegitimate president.
So Trump's lawyer saying she's biased for those reasons. Do you think statements like that would be a liability for Letitia James as she pursues these cases?
Well, they haven't been so far. I mean, it's been a pretty consistent argument by Donald Trump's lawyers in this case and in the criminal case, which resulted in the indictment of two Trump corporate entities and his chief financial officer. And we're actually waiting for some filings to be made public in that case pretty soon that will give us a sense of where that case is going. But back to the civil case, this is what Trump has been saying. He said it when the Manhattan District Attorney started his investigation, the former Manhattan District Attorney, Cyrus Vance, that he was politically motivated. He said it consistently with regards to Letitia James, the New York Attorney General. And I mean, there is a contradiction here because the New York Attorney General is an elected official that has to run statewide. In her case, it was a Democratic primary, which means that you have to run to the left. And in New York, that almost always means invoking Donald Trump, or at least it did in that period. So far, the judge has not really taken that into account in its filings. And in other cases, for example, the U.S. Supreme Court, when asked to consider this regarding the criminal case, also really didn't look at that. The more serious argument is the one that his lawyers raised.
Yeah, go ahead.
About whether he was told to do this by serious accountants and serious bankers. That could be a legal defense. I will note, however, in the most recent filing, the Attorney General said that part of the fraud was their claiming that things had been sanctioned by their accountants when they weren't. So we have to see how that plays out.
All right. Well, let's take a look at another case. This one from Georgia. The Fulton County District Attorney is investigating the former president as well. This one's related to the 2020 election. What is the legal exposure that he's facing there?
Well, the district attorney there would have to make the case that Donald Trump intended to tell Georgia officials to do something nefarious. Everybody heard the phone call where Trump said, I want you to find 11,000 plus votes. That's what I need to win. The question was he actually telling her to commit a crime, and did he know? However, this has been under investigation for a year. It was recently elevated, and this was sanctioned by judges in Georgia, to a special grand jury, which means there must be some level of evidence that this would produce a result, because otherwise cases don't proceed that way. On the other hand, the grand jury hasn't done its investigation, so we just don't know what the outcome will be.
Mm-hmm. So there's also the ongoing January 6th investigation in Congress, and when you look at the entirety of all of these cases, in what ways do you think they might hinder the former president's political future? And we have just about a minute.
You know, this is a question that I get almost all the time. People say, well, is it going to have an effect? The answer is, we don't know. Part of the reason we don't know is because nothing like this has ever happened before. There hasn't been a president who's faced so much exposure, including having his company under criminal indictment while he is considering running for president a second time. The answer is, it depends on who listens. It depends on if it has an effect. One thing we do know is this. If there's a trial, we will learn a whole lot more about how Donald Trump's business ran. That may give voters information that they find very interesting.
And we will be talking to you when that happens, NPR's, or if that happens, NPR's Andrea Bernstein. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great talking to you.
Remember this song?
This speech is my recital. I think it's very vital to rock around. That's right. On top. It's tricky. It's so tight. Here we go.
If you were around in the 1980s, or if you're on TikTok now, you probably know that's Run DMC. They were named the greatest hip-hop group of all time by MTV in 2007. They were trailblazers in music and fashion. But DMC, or Daryl McDaniels, has moved on. He launched the comic book publishing imprint Daryl Makes Comics, and he recently published his first children's book. It's called Daryl's Dream. We've got lots to talk about with Daryl McDaniels, and he's here to do that. DMC, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's good to be here and now.
Well, the star of your book here is a little boy, third grade. His name is Daryl. He's a poet. The kids at school, they bully him because he wants to sign up for the talent show. Yes. He's got chunky glasses. You know, he kind of reminds me of you, Daryl McDaniels.
Yeah, it is me. It is me. It's 100% me, minus the poetry part.
Are you trying to tell me that DMC got bullied in school?
I got bullied, teased, and picked on for a couple of things. Number one, I wore glasses. And before I started bragging about my glasses on records, when I was a kid, it was, hey, four eyes, hey, binoculars, hey, telescope. Like, it was the worst. I got teased, bullied, and picked on because I read comic books. And on top of the comic books and being a geek and a nerd, I was a straight-A student, always on the honor roll. So everything that was good about me to these bullies and the knuckleheads, it seemed like I wasn't worth anything. I wasn't necessary. That didn't fit in. And I just wasn't the cool kid.
Wow, you showed them, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I remember all of them now.
You did have a tough start as a kid, though, didn't you? You were in foster care for a while, then adopted. Now, what was childhood like for you outside of school?
I had the best parents ever. They didn't let me know I was adopted till I was 35 years old. But my home life was always good. Now, it's funny that you asked that question. The kids book basically came about because, if you remember, Peter, when I first introduced myself to the world, everybody knew me from high school to where I graduated high school, went to St. John's University for a brief period. Then I hooked up with Run and Jay, and we hooked up with Aerosmith, and we walked this way in our Adidas to tell the world how tricky it is to rock a rhyme. But my first rap was, I'm DMC, in the place to be. I go to St. John's University. And since kindergarten, I acquired the knowledge. After 12th grade, I went straight to college. So everybody has known me from high school to St. John's till now. I realized that I was always able to utilize actual situations in my life, whether it's Christmas time in Hollis, Queens, or, you know, I'm even so powerful, I could diss McDonald's and make everybody smile about it. Son of Byford, brother of Al. Banner's my mother and Run's my pal. It's McDaniels, not McDonald's. These rhymes are Daryl's. Those burgers are Ronald's. So I realized, okay, if people know me from high school to St. John's to walk this way with Aerosmith, I could actually talk about Daryl when he was in kindergarten, Daryl when he was in first grade, second grade, but I don't have to do it on a song. Maybe if I put it in a book so that when the kids read it, it's in their scenarios. I'm just letting them know about the young DMC, who's no different from any man, woman, boy, or girl on the face of the earth.
That was such a joyful answer to my question. Thank you very much. Now, it was great to hear your rhymes here on Zoom, but let's listen to a recorded single, okay? This is from 1983, your first. Run DMC, along with DJ Run, you and Jam Master Jay, you guys were so popular. What made you so good?
When you saw Run DMC and Jam Master Jay, you didn't see celebrity. It was something that could relate to everybody. It was school, it was family. And even if we talked about crime and poverty, one of the things that we never did, we never told anybody, you're wrong for being in a gang or you're wrong for stealing and lying. We showed them the alternatives and the options so that they could tap into their own greatness.
So in the process of doing that, you get a lot of credit in your career for shaping music, for actually shaping popular culture. And everyone who knows Run DMC knows this song, which you've already mentioned. You covered it with Aerosmith in 1986. Let's listen. Okay, so thank you for bringing me back to my childhood here, but it didn't maybe seem like such a big deal at the time, but by blending rock and rap in a song like that, you were on to something. What do you think the impact of that song has been?
I travel the world, and the impact is this. People from South Sudan, Africa, to Moscow, Russia, to Japan, to Israel say, Daryl, when Steven Tyler took that microphone and knocked down the wall that was separating y'all in that video, that didn't just happen in the video or the record. It happened in the world. We literally and figuratively knocked down all the walls that were separating us because we had all these misconceptions. Oh, only black people do hip hop and white people do rock and roll. Once Aerosmith connected with our generation through hip hop, it opened up the rainbow for all the generations to follow. I mean, we changed fashion, we changed music, and we changed the way pop culture looks at and respects each other.
I'm sitting here listening to your outlook on life, which is uplifting, and it's almost hard for me to believe that in 2017 you wrote a memoir called 10 Ways Not to Commit Suicide. Can you tell me about your struggle with depression and addiction?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. You go through life with all these fears, anxieties, and thoughts of, am I good enough? What should I be doing? Am I supposed to be doing this? Which is normal for anybody in the face of the world. But a lot of times, we allow guilt and shame to bring on a lot of pain. So for me, outside of all my, you know, great achievements, I woke up one day with feeling like that there was this void in me.
You were rich. You were famous. You were DMC. Yes. How is that possible?
Yes, but that look, rich and famous and then does nothing if you don't feel good about who you are, what you are, and the things that you want to do. So what you start doing is you start doing unhealthy behaviors and practices, which you think is allowing to get you through this turmoil or get you through this depression. You start turning to things outside of you. My thing was alcohol. So on 1993 to 2004, I was an alcoholic, suicidal, metaphysical wreck, drinking myself to death, wanting to commit suicide. But it was until I went to rehab to stop drinking when I discovered the most powerful thing. I discovered this thing, Peter, called therapy. And it allowed me to admit, I'm scared. I'm vulnerable. I'm weak. And it felt so good. I went in there and confessed all my weakness and fears. And I walked out of there like the Incredible Hulk.
Are you saying, though, that you no longer suffer from those questions about yourself and your fears and your anxiety, that you no longer have suicidal thoughts?
No, I don't have suicidal thoughts, but I still get those feelings. But I don't allow those things to tell me I'm not worthy, I shouldn't be here, or there's no way I could get through this. If you spend every day acknowledging your feelings, you'll discover the people, place, or thing causing them. And here's one of my most famous rhymes. If you remove guilt and shame, you remove the pain. So you go through life. And one of the important things about my kids' book is it's addressing feelings that these kids have when they're at that age, that if they never address them, that same anxiety that had you scared of going to fifth grade class will come back to haunt you when you're that doctor in that operating room or when you got to wake up the next morning and go to work.
So I'm listening to that rhyme you just shared with us, and I'm also thinking about the book that you just wrote. You're a man of many talents. Are you at the point where you're starting to think about your legacy?
No, that's the farthest. That's why I don't have no anxiety no more. I don't care about the results. What happened to me in my career, you get gold records, you get hit movies, you get touchdowns and stuff like that. And then people start telling you, you need something. They go, you need money. They go, you need to be on the charts. You need to be champion. No, all you need is to be happy about what you are doing. I'm at a point in my life where I realize a lot of the things that we worry about is just that, things that we worry about. Let me not worry about the result. Let me not worry about where I'm going to go. Let me just think about what I want to do.
Daryl McDaniels, the new book for kids is Daryl's Dream. DMC, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And DMC will do a virtual reading of Daryl's Dream tomorrow. You can participate. We're going to tell you how to do that at hereandnow.org.
Jackson State University says it first received a bomb threat at 4:15 Tuesday morning. Calvert White is a junior there and says he first learned about it on social media.
My first thought was that it definitely was not coincidental. These are not individual threats.
Officials later concluded that the bomb threats were unsubstantiated. Campus activities continued with greater law enforcement presence. But White says even though the threat didn't materialize, he's still deeply disturbed by it.
Especially as an HBCU student, we are constantly under pressure and under stress, you know, outside factors that have nothing to do with us in our education that are trying to, you know, limit us in any way possible.
Some JSU students, like Roderick Talley, still did not feel it safe to return to campus. He says the bomb threats reminded him of other acts of violence, both in decades past and more recent.
It made me very, very uneasy, and I was almost instantly reminded of the 1963 bombing in Birmingham at 16th Street Baptist Church. And I just thought, like, you know, if people are in this day and age, if you think about how they rioted the Capitol, I take it very serious. I took it very serious.
Several other HBCUs in Mississippi, including Alcorn State University and Tougaloo College, received threats. So did a number of HBCUs in other states, including Maryland. Here's Aminta Bro, president of Bowie State University, during a press conference Monday.
We've been here for over 150 years providing education, outstanding, excellent education to our students, and that's our mission. So no, we will not be deterred.
You think about what has historically been the role of an HBCU. They serve to raise the consciousness of Black people in the United States.
James Thomas is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Mississippi. He says this wave is a part of a pattern of scare tactics seen throughout history.
What's the purpose of the bomb threat? The aim is to sort of silence potential dissent, to instill fear, to reassert dominance.
The FBI is investigating the threats and has reportedly identified persons of interest. Here in Mississippi, Governor Tate Reeves took to Twitter, pledging that the state will do everything in its power to keep Mississippians safe. Like many other HBCUs that were targeted this week, Howard University in Washington, D.C. is beefing up security and offering counseling to those who need it. Howard's president, Wayne Frederick.
And in this month of Black History, we must remember that those who came before us had these fights and larger fights to fight. But the reason that they won is because they did it together.
It's a call to action that Jackson State University student Calvert White is urging his counterparts at other HBCUs to follow.
Please understand that this is a much bigger fight than just prominent leaders or student activists. Each and every one of y'all are leaders. Understand that your voice is just as important as the next person's. So please, please speak up.
For Here and Now, I'm Brittany Brown.
On Sunday, the United Kingdom begins a year-long celebration of Queen Elizabeth's Platinum Jubilee. That means 70 years on the throne, far longer than any other British monarch. But the reign of Queen Elizabeth has had its ups and downs. Let's talk about all this with Frank Langfitt, NPR correspondent in London. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Scott.
So tell us about the plans for this Jubilee year.
Yeah, there are a lot of things planned. One is right now going on. There's going to be a platinum pudding competition. The winner will have their pudding named after the Queen. The big event, though, Scott, is going to come during a 4-day bank holiday in early June. There'll be a big parade coming out of Buckingham Palace with lots of musicians. There'll be a live concert with musical stars. And when this was done 10 years ago at the Diamond Jubilee, Paul McCartney, Elton John were there. Then there are going to be street parties and picnics. One amusing note, more than 10,000 pieces of merchandise for the celebration, including cups and plates, actually misspelled the word Jubilee as Jubbly. So those are now being sold as genuine, genuine rarities.
J-U-B-B-L-Y, something like that?
Correct. J-U-B-B-L-Y.
Yeah. And a merchant has already stepped in, I understand, to sell the typos.
Indeed.
Yeah. Now, the Queen has had this job for 7 decades, which is longer than most anybody holds any job. How is she generally viewed today by the British people?
I think very favorably. Her approval rating is at 76%, though it has not always been that way. She, you know, as you were saying, she has had her ups and downs. If you go back to 1997, the death of Princess Diana, when the Queen did not come down initially to London to mourn, the public was really angry with her. But she bounced back, as she always does. And basically today, I think she's seen as the nation's wise grandmother, gives very comforting speeches. One I remember where she likened the fight against COVID to the sort of spirit the Britons gave to the resistance of the Nazis during World War II. This is Dominic Grieve. He's a former government minister, and this is how he sees it.
The monarchy is a great stabilizing influence. The United Kingdom's gone through a period of immense change in the course of her reign, but we have a great sense of continuity and history and stability, and the Queen is, I think, an essential ingredient in that.
Of course, Frank, the last few years have been a challenging time for the royal family. Prince Harry and Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, they left the UK, moved back to the States amid charges the family was racist, which it denied. And Prince Andrew is currently facing sexual abuse allegations involving an underage girl, which he denies. Will this overshadow these celebrations for the Queen?
I don't think so, Scott. I mean, people are pretty sympathetic to the Queen in both these cases. Britons feel they threw a fabulous wedding for Harry and Meghan, and then the couple became unhappy and left. And also, as to Andrew, many people, I think, feel the Queen has been far too indulgent of him. Last month, he lost all his royal duties, though, and that was seen as the royal family distancing themselves from Andrew to avoid it kind of clouding these celebrations.
Yeah. Now, Queen Elizabeth is the only Queen of England most of the world has ever known. What will the monarchy look like when she's no longer there?
Well, that's a big question, and it's become a bit more prominent recently because she hasn't been in the greatest health. She hasn't been seen really at any public events in a couple of months, which is very, very unusual. And this is beginning to raise a little bit of uncertainty. You know, what will things look like? One problem is that the Queen is actually more popular than the institution itself. This is a guy I also talked to, Max Hastings. He's a former editor of the Daily Telegraph here in the Evening Standard.
Many millions of people have enormous respect and affection for the Queen, who has been on the throne since before they were born, long before they were born in many cases. But they're much less committed to the institution of monarchy. And I suspect that we may discover that the monarchy in Britain is a more fragile institution than it seemed for all these years that Queen Elizabeth has been on the throne.
Now, next in line to the throne is, of course, Prince Charles. How much are people looking forward to his reign?
Not much, to be honest.
Huh.
Many here still blame him for the collapse of his marriage with Princess Diana.
Yeah.
I was talking to a professor named Pauline McLaren. She has researched the royal brand over at Royal Holloway. That's University of London, not too far from where I live. And this is what she thinks about Charles.
Charles will be allowed much less leeway in terms of his reign. I don't think the British public will tolerate much from the monarchy once Charles is seen to be in charge. And that is risky because there are many people always calling for the monarchy to be completely abolished. What value do they bring is always a question that is raised by the British public.
So, Scott, whenever the Queen does pass away, all eyes here are going to certainly be on Prince Charles. And the stakes for the monarchy are going to be very high.
Frank Langfitt is NPR's correspondent in London. Frank, thank you as always.
Great to talk, Scott.
Well, today the world is watching the opening ceremony of the Beijing Winter Olympics. But let's travel back about a century to the 1924 Winter Olympics in Chamonix, France. In that ceremony, the U.S. team paraded behind the American flag carried by hockey player Clarence Taffy Able. But here's what few people knew at the time. Taffy Able was the first indigenous athlete to carry the flag, and he'd become the first to medal for the U.S. at the Winter Olympics. Troy Oppy has the story.
Silent video from the International Olympic Committee shows Taffy Able, as flag bearer, leading a group of about two dozen bundled-up American dignitaries and athletes through the snow-covered French streets.
A Native American carrying our stars and stripes nearly 100 years ago.
That's George Jones, Taffy Able's now 73-year-old nephew by marriage. Family stories tell how Abel, his sister Gertrude, and his mother Charlotte, a Canadian Chippewa and U.S. citizen by marriage, all passed themselves off as white, mostly by not talking about it. They lived in Sault Ste. Marie in northern Michigan.
The main thing that they were fearful of, that Taffy and his sister would be taken away to, you know, an Indian residential school.
Such schools were one way the United States tried to eradicate indigenous heritage from Native people. Jim Adams is senior historian with the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. He says census documents showing today's Native population at 20 times what it was in 1890 isn't because more Native Americans exist.
It's because people were hiding their Indian identity in a period when it was a definite disadvantage.
In 2012, Adams curated an exhibition honoring indigenous Olympians. He says while racial passing was common among Native Americans, it was more rare for Olympic athletes.
A lot of the competitors like Jim Thorpe and Louis Tawanima were sponsored by Carlisle Indian Industrial School. So their identity, both as Indian and as products of the Indian boarding school system, was very well known, in fact, quite publicized.
Jones, Abel's nephew, doesn't think success would have come as easily to his uncle.
Taffy would have never got in to the 1924 Winter Olympics if he would have came right out and say, hey, I'm Native American. And I know he wouldn't have got in to the white-dominated NHL hockey world either.
After the Olympics, Able joined teams in the National Hockey League. He won the Stanley Cup twice, with the New York Rangers in 1928 and the Chicago Blackhawks 6 years later. His size and toughness made him a dominant player. He was known as a 60-minutes man because he rarely left the ice. After his NHL days ended, in 1939, he formed an amateur hockey organization back home in Michigan named the Sioux Indians in honor of his late mother, his native roots on display from that point until he died in 1964.
When somebody would ask him, they would say, Taffy, what business you're in? Taffy would always say, I'm in the business of winning.
Able is in the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame and the American Indian Athletic Hall of Fame. And while Canadian Fred Saskamoose is widely credited with being the first Native player in the NHL in the 1950s, both Jones and Adams say it was actually Taffy Able a quarter century earlier. Jones has long advocated for more recognition of Abel as the NHL's first Indigenous player. Today is another step toward that recognition, proclaimed Taffy Abel Day on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives by Michigan Congressman Jack Bergman.
To me, the big issue here is not so much about Taffy Abel, but it's Native American justice. If it doesn't happen on my watch, you know, I got a son, he'll follow up, and I got grandsons, and they'll follow up.
Jones also hopes for the return of Abel's 1924 Olympic silver medal, which he says was stolen from the family home in 1964. For NPR News, I'm Troy Oppie.
A seemingly innocuous Instagram caption has landed Vogue France in hot water. Last week, the fashion magazine posted photos praising actress Julia Fox for wearing a headscarf, and many critics were quick to point out a double standard given France's anti-hijab legislation. Here to walk us through some of the controversy is Femi Okeh. She is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, always good to speak with you. Thanks for joining us.
You're very, very welcome, Peter. Hello.
Hey, so tell us about that post that sparked this controversy.
All right, so on Vogue France on Instagram, Julia Fox is dressed in a belted trench coat, black gloves, purse, retro sunglasses, and a black scarf. The post next to it says, "Yes to the scarf!" Exclamation mark. Swipe left for your recap of Julia Fox and Kanye West's style journey at the haute couture shows in Paris this week. The four words that caused the discussion, "Yes to the scarf." Kubi Abi, who wears hijab, says that this Vogue France writing, "Yes to the headscarf," as if the country hasn't banned a very specific demographic from wearing them. She is incredulous at the post.
All right, you've done some reporting on this, and let's get into that some more. You spoke with the fashion content producer, Hanan Washmi. Her posts about this have helped fuel a global discussion. Here she is discussing French culture.
They'll actually bully you and remind you constantly that you do not belong. And could be a scarf. Today, the whole topic is around the scarf, but it's also your name. It's also your pigmentation.
And tell me more, Femi, how people are responding to this controversy online.
The response started in France, but went beyond France. Women, men, Muslims and non-Muslims, believing that Vogue France was basically tone deaf to a situation in France where culturally and with religious headwear, there is an ongoing debate about what should and should not be worn in public. So IF Colin, for instance, posts, "There's a double standard of praising wearing a headscarf in a country that actively oppresses Muslim women from doing the same. It's shameful." Mm.
Right. So the context that you just mentioned is that lawmakers in France have passed or proposed a number of laws that would discourage or even ban the religious headwear in public spaces. So some people say this is targeting women, Muslim women specifically. And again, you spoke with another person here, Rim Sara Alouan, a legal scholar who focuses on religious freedom and civil liberties in France. Here she is.
It's extremely tense, and it's really worrying to see how women's bodies are politicized and instrumentalized. It goes against human rights and women's rights.
For people who are just catching up to this story, how politicized is the hijab in French society?
Very. There are lawmakers who assert that they have to protect France's secular values. So the legislation tackles what they describe as Islamist radicalism. On the other side of that debate is a human rights debate, freedom to practice your religion how you want to, and literally policing what women wear. There's even a campaign called Hands Off My Hijab, so women can decide if they're Muslim and they want to represent their faith by covering their hair, why can't they? Why does the state have to step in?
In fact, there's also people who believe that art and fashion should be disconnected from politics. Do you think that's possible? Can it be?
In France, absolutely not. Not because of the pressure about wearing hijab, covering your hair as a mark of showing your religion, and then politics and some politicians believing that you should not be showing your religion in public places. There is a debate. It's fierce. It's very uncomfortable, particularly for Muslim women.
This is not Vogue's first controversy over race. In 2018, Vogue Italia was criticized for a cover where model Gigi Hadid's skin appeared to be darkened. So there's that. How is Vogue responding to this?
Well, the post blew up. Thousands of people went to post on it. And what they did simply was to remove four words. Yes to the scarf is taken out. The rest of the post is there. If you go to Vogue France, you can see all of the commentary, all of the criticism. And when I spoke to Hanan earlier on today, she says that that sentence, the sentence that Vogue France took out, reflects France today. They will say yes to the headscarf only if you wear it as a fashion item. So it's really extraordinary to see that something that as lightweight as a frothy fashion post has reignited a big debate that is happening in France on a daily basis.
Sounds like you may be saying that Vogue's response taking out that phrase actually didn't quell the controversy.
Not at all. And I reached out to Vogue France to talk to them. They haven't spoken to anybody. It's almost as if they're sort of ducking down, allowing that debate to continue, thinking, oh, we're just going to go back to the post and fashion pictures and not worry about the bigger cultural debate. But it's going on a daily basis. Every time somebody who is Muslim, who wears a hijab, is going out and about, that is the debate there in French society.
Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, thanks as always.
You're so welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now.